This is Steve Maxner conducting an interview with Mr. Mac Thompson on the 6th of September, October 2002, at approximately 11:30. We are at Mayuri's Restaurant in Nantaburi, Thailand. Thank you, sir, first of all, for consenting to this interview. And let's begin with a brief discussion of your early life. If you would tell me when and where you were born, where you grew up.
Yeah, well, I was born June 11, 1941, in Portland, Oregon. And just as a kid, we lived in various places around the immediate Portland area. Went to grade school. And, well, in 1953, we moved to Lake Oswego, just a few miles south of Portland. Graduated high school there in 1959.
Okay.
And at that point, went off to college, Colorado School of Mines, Golden, Colorado, for 2 years. And you know, I have a super respect for people who graduated from that school. It's a tough school, and I made it 2 years there. Then it was time to leave. Then I went back to Oregon State University, and entered their forest engineering program, and graduated in June of '63 at Oregon State in forest engineering.
What did your mom and dad do?
Pardon?
What did your mother and father do?
Oh, mom, as typical, in those days, was a housewife. And took care of the house and took care of the kids, myself and my sister. My dad worked for the civilian for the Corps of Engineers. He had started that before World War II. And as a civilian, again, a low GS grade. Was in the Army for a couple years toward the end of the war, then out of the Army back to the Corps of Engineers. So he ended up retiring in 1969 in the Corps.
What did he do in the Army?
My dad?
When he was in during the last couple years of the war?
Well, as he described it, when I was back in the States earlier this year, my sister got going through all sorts of letters, had found some letters from him, and letters, he went in 1944. He was 35 years old, with two kids. Only one kid at that time. Way beyond the draft age. But he declined a further deferment. So because he said once in later years, he said, "Well, I want to be able to tell my son, what did you do during the war, Daddy?" "Well, not much, but I was in the Army." So he was in the Army, basic training, and then went to OCS, second lieutenant. As an old man, comparatively 35, was relegated to the Transportation Corps. Then the war ended. He was booked to be sent over to Europe when all the big demos came. So he was let out of the Army at that point.
Okay. Did you have any uncles or other close relatives that served in World War II as well?
Well, I had one uncle, on the father's side, was a U.S. Naval Academy graduate. McDonald Thompson. He graduated in 1937, I think it was, and went on to be a pilot and a carrier pilot. I've got some papers at home here that, again, my sister dug out. Was a torpedo bomber expert, and did a couple of carrier tours in the Pacific, and then about 1943 or 44. Was killed in a training accident in Honolulu. His widow, well, they had two boys called the twins that I've never met. They live in Los Angeles. My sister finally met them about 6 months ago after all these years.
Wow. What a shame.
And let's see, I think that was the only the only military we had. Uncles type thing. The others were, too old or female.
Okay. Now, when you were going through high school, were you drawn to any particular subjects?
Oh, I always kind of liked, math and science, physics. I wasn't a great superstar in all of these. Didn't like biology or that type of thing. But, more of the, I guess we call them hard sciences, others interested in always have been, but do a little bit of reading still do with some anthropology, archaeology. It's fun to dig through things, but not much on the great philosophies or economics type subjects.
History?
Pardon?
Any interest in history?
Not, well, some ancient history, you know, okay. Not really modern histories at all.
How much of an influence did your dad have on your choice after you left high school to go into go to Colorado School of Mines and become an engineer?
Probably
ultimately?
Not very much at all. One thing Dad had was he had contracted cancer while he was in the Army. And 1946, I think it was, he amputated his left leg, but up and including part of the hip bone, which is at that time, a very serious operation, that high-end operation.
Yes.
He had got a wooden leg from the VA, but again, it was a wooden leg and too heavy and awkward. So he never used a wooden leg. He was on crutches until he died. But he started, that was in 47, so 49. Mm-hmm. He still kind of thought, kids should learn how to, shoot a gun and the like. So I got my first gun 22 at 8 years old, and, mm-hmm. With all the proper cautions, and a shotgun, at 9 or 10, and my first deer out with him, mm-hmm. Hunting too at, 12 years old. He never let me have a BB gun, because mm-hmm. BB guns, you're toys, you can, put your neighbor kid's eyes out with,
right.
So
right.
I wasn't allowed to do that.
Okay. You got the real thing.
Pardon?
You got the real thing.
Yeah.
Now, with the shotgun, your first shotgun, was it a 410?
410, right.
Yeah.
And then a couple years later when he graduated, he bought himself a new one, an old 16-gauge semi-automatic, and so the old 12-gauge was handed down to me.
Uh-huh. And that's what you hunted with?
Huh?
Is that what you hunted with?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Deer, anything else?
Oh, well, rabbits and blue jays, mm-hmm. those are cheaper to shoot. Easier to do year-round. So, a good friend of mine in high school, John Rudin, he still lives in Lake Oswego. We were out, quite often, during the wintertime, even the summertime, on, rabbit hunting runs out to eastern Oregon, some of the ducks and pheasants and the like. So mm-hmm. we did a lot of hunting as a kid.
Yeah. Okay.
So, we talked about the parental emphasis on choice of schools, not much there, but one thing I've always been interested in airplanes.
Okay.
And not really quite sure why, but like them, got a bunch of stuff on my websites and a lot of books on airplanes, and I don't really understand why I went in the Army instead of the Air Force, except it never dawned on me, talking with my dad, he'd been in the Army all the way through college, well, it's just automatic, I'll go in the Army. That's mm-hmm. one of the check marks I have to do in life.
Okay.
Not so much have to do, should you. But.
Yes. Now, did you get into civilian piloting at all?
No.
Take courses or anything?
No, I thought about it. I started skydiving when I was out in the School of Mines at 18.
Mm-hmm.
And, I kind of like to joke about it. If I was a student pilot, soloing, with 10, 15 hours, the engine hiccups, I jump because I know I could get out, I could get down to the ground safely jumping.
Uh-huh.
Not sure about dead sticking it, on a highway. So,
okay.
In Laos, sort of defensive major, I learned how to, land a helio and mm-hmm. land a porter mm-hmm. in case there was a problem with the pilot.
Yeah.
And I could do a sort of controlled crash with an H-34 helicopter. This was, again, 1969, 1970.
Mm-hmm.
But, the only time I really heard it happening, a friend of mine lives down in Eugene, Oregon. He was in a Jet Ranger. This was about 1971 or 72, mm-hmm. when the pilot was gunshot over in the Taukeck area, across the Pompano.
Yeah.
And he helped fly the airplane until they got to a safe area, and the pilot was able to put it down on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So that was defensive flying, I
okay.
guess.
Yeah. Now, when you graduated from high school, did you know that you were going to definitely go to college?
That I was going to go?
Yeah, did you know
as
you were graduating from high school, definitely you're going to go to school?
Yeah,
no doubt about it.
No doubt at all. I was just going on to college. I didn't really, I thought about it in later years, but after I left Colorado School of Mines, I was a little bit down in the dumps, not having done very well there. And I started thinking about maybe, take a couple of years out and go in the Army.
Mm.
And, Dad, I think rightly said, no, don't do that. Just continue on. Finish the college. And in later years, I've seen, it takes a lot of discipline, I think, for someone who takes a break after high school for 2 to 4 years and then to go back to college. And I'm not sure I would have had that discipline.
Okay. Well, why did when you got to Oregon State, why did you choose forest engineering? What drew you to that?
Well, it was the engineering side of it as opposed to growing the trees. Oregon State had three majors: the the regular forestry that sort of grew the trees, the engineers who cut them down, built the roads and cut them down, the forest products who made something marketable out of it. And I always liked forestry, I liked the trees, liked the woods, so it seemed like a logical thing to do. Yeah. And it also fit, kind of the budget, given the courses I had already had at the School of Mines, everything kind of melded and meshed so I could, do a still a four-year graduation program instead of having to spend an extra year.
Okay. Well, while we're on the subject of your education, did you find that your choice there for forest engineering and that classes that you took at Colorado School of Mines, did that come in handy later on when you found yourself in a jungle and heavily wooded environment like Laos?
No. The best course I figure I ever took in high school or college was my senior year of high school typing class. Just a regular old secretarial typing on manual Underwood machines.
Yeah.
And I've used more than I have anything else my life.
Uh-huh. Okay.
After I finished college, June of 63, I needed to pay off some bills, so I asked for a delay of going to the Army until November 63. And I worked that summer out in Eastern Oregon for BLM, Bureau of Land Management, and then another month for the Forest Service in Oregon. Then went in the Army and never got back to, forestry at all. Just absolutely zero.
Oh, that's funny. Okay. Well, when you...
Let me interject one thing
here.
It's still, kind of like maybe nowadays you might consider a master's degree, as a minimum, a ticket punching to get a job in anything. Well, and when did I graduate in 63? Okay, that's almost 39 years ago. Mm-hmm. It wasn't quite to the point that a master's degree was a ticket punching exercise, but for me, maybe it was. I graduated, and that opened up a lot of doors in later years. Didn't matter what the degree was in, you just had to have one.
Well, when you graduated from college, did you know you were going to go immediately into the Army or
into the
Army?
I had my orders already.
You did?
Yeah.
When did you get those?
Well, from ROTC.
Okay, so this was a land-grant school? Oregon State was a land-grant school, so you had to take ROTC.
Land-grant schools, you only have to take ROTC for 2 years.
Right.
And I did that at School of Mines.
Okay.
And when I went to Oregon State, I applied for the... second 2 years,
okay.
The senior ROTC program. So
right.
At graduation, we did that in our
commission.
Army uniform, and you got the bars pinned on after you got your diploma.
Yep. Okay. So and this brought with it a 2-year commitment in the Army.
2 years, right.
Yeah. And of course, since your degree was in forest engineering, it made sense that you branched engineering.
Oh, right. Well, at Oregon State, they had two or three branches, and they specialized in the ROTC course. I think nowadays is more general ROTC, but at Oregon State, we took engineering ROTC in the Army side of it.
So there's no doubt about what branch you'd be in when you got into the Army. Okay. Well, why don't you describe first where you went for your initial Army training, your basic course, and what was that introduction to the active duty military life like for you?
Oh, well, it was not much different. It was a more of an academic thing. We were staying in the BOQs at Fort Belvoir.
Mm-hmm.
That was November through 63 through end of January 64. BOQs, classes, indoor classes, outdoor classes, demolition, bridge building, some construction techniques, a 1-week field exercise. And all during this time, my orders at that time were to Fort Devens, Massachusetts for my 2 years. And we had a guy come down to the Pentagon one day for personnel. Said, hey, all of you lieutenants, you're all second lieutenants, you're all 1331s, MOS, anybody want to change their orders, just let us know by, the deadline. So I put a little 3x5 card up on the bulletin board, anybody want to go to Fort Devens? And one guy contacted me, he was going to Germany, but that was 3 years, and I didn't want to do another year.
Yeah.
Another guy was going to Korea, and it was wintertime, and that didn't sound very good. about a day before the deadline, another lieutenant comes up and says, "Hey, I've been looking for you. And, I'm from 50 miles from Fort Devon. My wife's 7 months pregnant. Would you swap? Well, mm-hmm. Where are you going?" "Well, you know, Korat, Thailand." Well, I knew where Thailand was. No idea where Korat was. Mm-hmm. But, you know, given the day before the deadline, okay, I'll swap. So yeah. Just on a fluke, 38 uh-huh. and a half years later, I'm still here.
How long did you have until you left for Thailand?
Pardon?
When did you leave for Thailand? That was February of 64.
Right. Well, I drove a car with all my stuff from Fort Belvoir back to Oregon. Mm-hmm. That was about a 2 week trip. And, mid February, 16 Feb or 19 Feb, 64, arrived in Bangkok for 2 days and up to Korat.
Now, did you know what you'd be doing? Were you told what your primary responsibility
was? Well, I had a unit assignment, the 528th Engineer Detachment Utility.
Okay.
Which had about 25 troops, NCOs and enlisted men, mm-hmm. and kind of one second lieutenant, and that was the post engineer for Camp Friendship and for Camp Yusertai at Korat. Mm-hmm. There was also the officer in charge was not on the books. It was a major, engineer major. Mm-hmm. We had at that time about 160 some Thai. Working with us, from carpenters and plumbers, on up. And, that would have been, more than a second lieutenant would normally have. And then also, we were attached to the 44th Engineer Headquarters Company. And the one or two officers there and their troops were also involved in the post-engineer work. So there was a little 528 as kind of an offset, and then kind of an amorphous organization, the 44th Headquarters Company. Mm-hmm. We all cooperated and did the same work. And at that time, in February 64, the entire U.S. Air Power in Korat was commanded by a captain and had about 40 enlisted men mm-hmm. and no airplanes.
And what were they doing?
Well, they were sort of standing by for the Vietnam War to start. And it was August 64, what was that, the Gulf of Tonkin?
Yes.
Incident when suddenly airplanes started, flying into Korat, and the Air Force, just started building up like mad. The Army didn't change the strength very much. Our Army was always at about, 1,000, 1,200 people. Mm-hmm. And the Air Force went from 40 people up to Korat, 10 or 12,000 people.
Well, what were your responsibilities there with the 528th? What kind of projects did you work on?
Well, we were doing camp construction. The basic mm-hmm. camp was already there. Mm-hmm. But you saw, I don't know, did you go to the NKP, the air base, mm-hmm. the NKP around there? You saw the concrete buildings.
Oh, yes.
But at this time, in 64, everything was wood mm-hmm. at Camp Friendship and at the air base. We were building the wooden hooches, 16 by 32 foot, living quarters, mm-hmm. and building warehouses, 40 by 100 foot warehouses, 10 hole latrines, mm-hmm. Dug hole latrines, no flush toilets, and there were several clubs, officers, NCO, EM clubs we built, mess halls where we built. Mm-hmm. One of the Thai guys who was at the party, the reunion this past weekend, mm-hmm. Had worked for me as a plumber. At Korat, 64, mm-hmm. and he later went on to bigger and better things. Worked for the CIA in Laos as mm-hmm. one of the forward air guide. He was a support in the forward air guide program.
Okay. But what was his code name?
He didn't have a code name.
He was
support.
Okay.
Another guy that worked for me in Korat in our little 528 was a clerk typist, mm-hmm. and I ran into him up at Longchang in 1971. Mm-hmm. Just walking down the ramp, and he turned around and said, "Hey, Lieutenant Thompson, is that you? Weeboon, what the hell are you doing here?" I'm Wild Bill now. He's got his M16, and he's mm-hmm. all his camis and hardware and everything. And
damn.
He was all through the thick of the fighting up there at Longchang and the PDJ mm-hmm. in San Tong.
Wow. And his code name was Wild Bill?
Wild Bill. His call sign. Radio call sign was Wild Bill.
Yeah.
He had started out with us at Korat, in 64 as a clerk typist.
Mm-hmm. Well, these barracks and other facilities that you were building at Camp Friendship, who were they being built for? Were they anticipated Americans coming over?
We had the U.S. Army that we were initially building for and doing maintenance. And then when the Air Force started coming in August 64,
okay.
We went over to just about 90% building for the construction for the Air Force.
Okay.
For their buildup through the end of 64, mm-hmm. It took them that long to get their own base CE people, their base civil engineer people in, and their procurement mm-hmm. system set up, to buy lumber and cement, mm-hmm. wire and plumbing and everything else they needed.
Now, were there any other engineering organizations helping with this stuff?
Not at the construction, the repair and utilities at Korat, no.
Okay.
It had been built, it started, I think, in 63, possibly late 62,
mm-hmm.
and one company, the 561st Heavy Construction Company had done a major effort on the construction, but they were pulled out of Korat in about November 63 to move south of Korat and work with the 809th Engineer Battalion on the Bangkok Bypass Road,
okay.
which at that time was, I think, one of the larger, strictly U.S. Army projects in the mm-hmm. world.
Was there very much interaction and cooperation between American Army engineers and Thai Army engineers?
Not there at Korat, no.
Okay.
The 809th at the south of Korat on the Bangkok Bypass Road did have a Thai battalion working with them.
Mm-hmm.
They also worked, the 809th later went up and did the rebuild of the, this 1967-68, rebuild of the road in the northeast from Sukhonakon on over to Konpano. And I don't remember the Thai battalion's number, but it's on a couple of the websites.
Okay. Well, when you first arrived, February 64, I failed to ask you three months earlier, of course, Kennedy had been assassinated.
Pardon?
Kennedy, President Kennedy had been assassinated.
November 63.
November
63.
Yeah, when you were still at Fort Belvoir. I wanted to ask you how that impacted you. How did affect you?
Well, surprise. Somebody came into our class,
mm-hmm.
and we were in academics at that time, and mm-hmm. made the announcement that classes had been canceled. And that was a Thursday? I forget the day of the week, but it made for a long weekend. And everything was canceled mm-hmm. for the next 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
It was an emotional time, I think. Well, I think for everybody there at Belvoir, but, not something that it was going to be pondering on for the next 10 years.
Yeah. Well, what did you think about President Kennedy's policies towards Southeast Asia? Did you have any opinions at the time?
I really didn't know that much about it. I had read about it, mm-hmm. Time, Newsweek magazine, earlier when I was in college.
Mm-hmm.
We did. I think I wrote a one page or two page paper, in the ROTC about Vietnam, because again I didn't know anything about Laos, and I had no idea, what we were doing in Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote this one or two page thing in maybe fall of 62 or earlier in 63,
mm-hmm.
Are we supporting the wrong people in Vietnam? With all the monks burning and everything else, mm-hmm. It just sounded like bad politics. And,
mm-hmm.
So that was, no big deep thoughts on the subject. And,
Well, when you got to Thailand in 64, what did you see in terms of how did you see your project and your work fitting into the larger American policy in Thailand? What were we trying to accomplish?
Well, I didn't know what the larger American policy in Thailand was.
Okay.
I don't think, I hadn't heard the domino theory at that time.
Okay.
I didn't know about the war in Laos, and mm-hmm. as I talked with a lot of people over the years, many of them, particularly Air Force, who were in Thailand,
mm-hmm.
Didn't know what was going on
mm-hmm.
in Laos with the bombings in Laos and on the Ho Chi Minh Trail,
mm-hmm.
The basic thing for Korat, or the major unit, the overall unit, there was a 9th Logistics Command B,
mm-hmm.
9th Log Command B, and its main reason for being was to have pre-positioned stocks for contingencies.
Yes.
We had 118 miles of pipeline there for fuel pipelines, and I think that was the pipeline that was put in later years. We had a large, again, this was not under our engineer unit, there's another unit that was in charge of what they call the SLAT depot, and I don't remember what SLAT stood for, but it was a strategic something or other. But it was vehicles, APCs, Deuce and Ham trucks, Jeeps, radio Jeeps, with markings on them for the 25th Infantry Division that was in, I was still in Hawaii at the time. You know, the idea being that, you know, alert would come, the 25th is flying into Karat, and people would get their batteries in, and get them gassed up, run out to the airport. You know, the troops would get off of their airplanes, get in the vehicle that's already, you know, the bumper plates are already marked for them, and go off to war. Then the 25th went to Vietnam, so somebody had a big painting job to do.
That's right.
But we had, there were a lot of things going on in Karat. There were the Seabees were there.
I was going to ask you about Seabees.
And we've been looking on the web, you know, trying to contact a few of the Seabees, this TLC group, and you know, a couple of other groups. You know, hey, you know, who are you? What were you doing? Because I'd remember them coming in once or twice a year, you know, coming in to pick up their equipment and disappear for 6 months, going out and doing civil affairs work, and come back in, turn the equipment in, and disappear.
The civil affairs work they did, was this, again, construction?
Yeah, I think they were out doing schools, you know, dispensary type thing. But I never really got to talk with them. There were a couple of special forces lieutenants in the area that would come in once a month to do a to pick up the pay basically, and pick up a load of beer. They'd one of the guys I talked with, USAM at that time, didn't have enough field staff, so they went out to the Army, I guess, and got some. I don't know if they were language qualified or not, but had people, U.S. Army people working for the Thai organization, working with the ARD, Accelerated Rural Development Program in Thailand.
Were they, did you know at the time if Special Forces were still operating into Laos?
At that time, I didn't know. That, again, was 64. So. Well, Special Forces, of course, had been in Laos back then. It was White Star Corps in the early 60s.
But they were, of course, as a result of the agreement in 63, we weren't supposed to have any military personnel working in Laos, but of course, that wasn't necessarily the case.
Right.
We still had people working in Laos, although they were not in uniform.
Right. Okay. Well, and we always had our attaché people, too, so yes. whether those counted or not, you know.
Right. Okay. And when did you first see Air America or Civil Air Transport operating in that area?
Well, Air America at that time. Uh-huh. And there was a USAID office in Karat, and they had a very, very small Porter airplane, and I was over there for some reason or other one day, and I saw a Porter there. That was Air America, and we had our own problems, and I wasn't really wondering what they were doing, and, you know, I heard later about them being up at Udorn as a base, but I had no idea that they were working in Laos at the time.
Did you know that? When did you learn that they were actually working as part of the CIA?
Oh, that was probably after I got to Laos.
Okay. That would
in 66.
66.
Right.
Okay.
And that was never
IBS.
That was never a secret. I mean, it was just, you know, common knowledge. You know, it was not something like somebody told me that, you know, over a bar, you know, swore me to silence.
Right. Well, but they did try to maintain the perception, the facade that this was just a civilian air corporation operating in Thailand and eventually in Laos.
Right.
And, you know, and then they had Cassie and Bird Air and Arizona Helicopters, and those were all also invited in as part of that facade. This is free market capitalism.
But, you know, I had never visited their office in Bangkok. Uh-huh. But I heard later, of course, that they were on, you know, Hat Bong.
Mm-hmm.
I visited the Udorn office, you know, just in 66, that was it, you know, on the way to Laos. But, I can't be precise on what I heard that they were CIA, but proprietary, but, you know, it just wasn't something
wasn't
that was questionable. You know, okay, fine, they are, but let's get on with the program.
Right.
You know, same with Continental. I mean, they had Continental and Air America, both had USAID contracts, and they had CIA contracts.
Mm-hmm.
Continental was not CIA,
but
they flew for both organizations.
Yes.
Or just when we were in Laos too, and we had I'd like to think back in the early 69 of the Walker Bach. We had three quarters, I think, two on the CIA contract, one on the USAID contract, and a lot of ground fog in the morning. So, the planes the night before would be loaded up with rice, and the pilots come out early in the morning. Maybe before we got there, they'd just take off through the fog, go up and do a rice drop, which was our USAID program. They'd come back, after an hour, and the fog would be burned off. Maybe do another rice drop, burned off at the airport, but not up country. Maybe do a couple more rice drops. Then they'd come back, and then all three quarters would go maybe do ammo drops or special drops, when the up country fog had burned off. But we didn't worry about cost sharing, and again, it was all one U.S. government program. When later people got into the cost sharing, and they did it along the bond, the two contracts working that week on the CIA contract would just sit on the ground, and the USAID guy would go off and fly, and he'd get 10 hours that day. The two Air America guys, or two CIA contractor guys for that day might get 7 hours, and they weren't very happy, but
yeah.
A bureaucratic cost.
Okay. Well, when you for your first tour with the Army in Thailand, yeah. In Karat, did you start learning Thai at that point?
A little bit, yeah. They, not deliberately learning Thai, but when you're there for a year, I kind of called the standard 100, 200 word GI vocabulary.
Yeah. So. The most important things.
Learn how to count.
Right.
Well, it was a lot more than I learned in later in my 2 years in Sudan or my almost 2 years in Russia, in Moscow.
Okay. All right. What were the rules about interacting with the Thai people? Were there any?
No, not that I recall at all. Well, we were generally working, say, 5.5, 6 days a week. Later, when the Air Force came in, we went over on a 7-day work week. Not 24 hours a day, 10 or 12 hours a day, but at least our unit, different units might have had different rules. We had, unless somebody screwed up, just say for the enlisted man, a pretty well 100% pass policy. Just be to work, at 6 o'clock in the morning, a morning formation, ready to go balls to the wall again.
Yeah.
And I remember once we had a old Chief Warrant Officer, W4 Amix. His kind of special punishment for somebody. I remember once we had an electrician come in, a GI, real good guy, but he was all hung over and he couldn't work very well. So Amick said, okay, well, up the pole. And up the pole on his spurs and stay there for 3 hours in the sun. Or if somebody got, I get calls, occasionally, from the MPs. Hey, Lieutenant, we got one of your guys down here, and we didn't have a jail at Karat. But they'd had a connex with windows cut in it for some ventilation and a grass roof over the top of it to keep some of the heat off, and cyclone fencing. So, okay, well, we'll be over mid-morning, noon to pick them up. But it got hot and it got uncomfortable, and I don't know, maybe that was the punishment. We didn't have much for Article 15 punishments in those days.
Okay. So it's basically... at the discretion of the senior NCOs and officers on site, what kind of punishment you dealt out, as opposed to an Article 15 or UCMJ punishment?
Well, we had court marshals there. We did not have general court martial authority. Those had to go back to Okinawa, but we had summaries, special and summary court martials at Karat. I ended up being a defense counsel on 11 court martials.
What were the infractions typically?
Mostly they were AWOL.
Okay.
For 3 to 5 days, the guy falls in love and he disappears and he gets caught or he comes back in.
Yeah.
said this is your first trip to Bangkok. You can see how that could happen.
Yes.
Even at your advanced stage.
Oh yeah, the temptations. Well, okay.
Right.
And any other major problems? Any discipline problems other than women and drinking?
Well. No, I
guess those would be the most important.
No, there might be fighting. There was one private we had, a PFC in our unit.
Yeah.
He was sort of drunk at the club and decided, the EM club decided he wanted to go downtown. So he went to the motor pool and, in essence, stole a deuce and a half truck. and drove it through the front gate because, you know, the Thai guards, they weren't going to let it through. So we drove it through the front gate, drove it downtown, wanted to go to this one particular bar or whorehouse, and the truck wouldn't fit down, you know, the little soy, the alley going to the house. So he just moved over and drove, put it in all-wheel drive and drove over the trees and everything and knocked down the front steps. So anyway, he was arrested. He's back. And, I forget what level of court-martial, not very high, but he was fined and busted and or made to pay back, you know, the thing. And then because he was a good guy, a good worker, you know, the day before he left, he was transferring back, you know, 6 months later or 4 months later to the Presidio, San Francisco. He was morning formation and gave his stripes back to him. You know, not me, you know, the company commander did.
So. That's decent.
So,
okay.
Yeah, there were, I don't remember any, you know, I'm sure there may have been, I just didn't hear of them, you know, bad, ugly incidents.
Yeah.
You know, not robberies, not things of this sort. I did have the CID people come in to see me one day, and, you know, said, right, well, we also had what we call the water point. We had our own water purification units that were located maybe 5-6 kilometers away from the camp. And he said, hey, Lieutenant, come with us. We had a big camp beautification program going on at the time, flowers around. We go down to the water point, and you know the CID NCO says, hey, Lieutenant, you know what those are? No, what's that? That's marijuana. Oh. So I think a couple of our guys who lived at the water point got in some trouble about it. I don't remember what punishment, if anything, they had. We watched the water point much closer after that.
Yeah. And how about in terms of drugs, what about opium?
I never heard anything about opium. Just like nowadays, though, up in northeast Thailand, you know, marijuana is pretty freely available. And some places, you know, back then, 30, 40 years ago, and probably some places now, you'll find it at restaurants, at a noodle shop, as one of the condiments to put in your soup, you know, dried marijuana.
Yeah.
I don't remember ever seeing it, you know, putting it in my soup, but, you know, it was available, just like in Laos. They were saying that marijuana, you know, packaged, already rolled, is cheaper than buying cigarettes.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
But I remember no incidents with drugs at all in my year in Karat at the time.
But is it still available in places like this as a condiment?
I doubt if it's so common here. Mm-hmm. In a way up country, out in the bush, it might be.
Okay.
But you know, the Thailand has become so conscious about the drugs, particularly the amphetamine problem, in the last 10, 15 years, and the police are doing a much. Those police were not involved in the drug trade are doing a much better job on controlling the narcotics in the kids' bush.
Well, you mentioned the water purification system. What kind of a system was that?
The Ertilator. It came from the Engineer Research and Development Lab, ADER. Invented, I think, at Fort Belvoir.
Okay.
That's where the Engineer Research and Development Laboratory was. It moved when all the engineers moved out of Fort Belvoir, Fort Leonard, but I think that unit is located there now. So we had, as I remember, two of them.
When for all of your construction, did you rely on domestic supply? Were all those supplies brought in, or a combination?
Mostly local purchase.
Local purchase.
You know, Bangkok and Karat. Again, we were going so fast on the construction, particularly after the Air Force moved in.
Yeah.
It is not at all uncommon for in the afternoon to take one of our lowboys, park it down downtown Karat at a lumberyard.
Mm-hmm.
It would show up the next morning. And with a load of lumber on it, and it would show up directly at the construction site, and it would be nailed on to a building right then. And it had just been sawed the day before, so not kilt-dried. You know, over the next weeks or months, things would bend and crack and get holes in them as they dried out.
Yeah.
You know, nails were not a very high quality at the time. They bend a lot. This is a Thai softwood, Mayan. Is about the same density, slightly less density than oak and walnut in the U.S. And those are pretty good U.S. hardwood.
Yeah, they are.
So we went through lots and lots of nails. We bought wire and lighting, electrical stuff was all bought locally. Toilet paper, I think we came from the U.S. Plywood from the U.S.
But. Okay. Let's see. Other shortages or problems with materials?
Not that I...
Let's take a break for a second.
Not that I remember particularly.
Okay. If you needed something that you could typically find here locally.
Well, usually, I mean, we did buy things from the U.S. We were doing rehab on the 31st Field Hospital, so we needed static group, non-static linoleum for the operating room for the hospital. That was ordered from the U.S. And other items that we ordered from the U.S. But we were again buying construction type materials. Other units, workman's unit. Medical units were probably buying all or most of their stuff from the U.S.
Okay.
or ordering it from RV depots in Okinawa.
Well, I've talked about water purification as supplies. Were there any other interesting events or challenges to your first year in Thailand?
In retrospect, I think it's kind of an awakening.
Mm-hmm.
Just to another part of the world. I had never been to Canada before, never been to Mexico. Canada's pretty close to Portland, Oregon, and I just never had any real incentive to go up there. It was that was probably the most significant event. I went back to the States. I had another 9 months in the Army. That was at Dugway, Utah, about 8 months, at Dugway Proving Grounds, outside of Salt Lake City. And I got out of the Army and started sending out job applications, and I was interested in getting back to this part of the world.
Yeah.
So they were all kind of oriented for either surveying, engineering, whatever, but not having had a lot of real working experience. I had a number of reject letters. I applied for a kicker job with Air America.
Huh.
Had a reject letter from them. I applied for a job with USAID. Particularly USAID Vietnam or USAID Laos.
Mm-hmm.
This would have been late fall of 65, early 66, had a reject letter from USAID too,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of strange in retrospect since I ended up retiring from USAID.
Yeah, that is funny. Okay. Well, what did you do at Dugway?
Dugway initially signed papers. Mm-hmm. By law, it takes a Corps of Engineers officer to sign a number of reports and papers. So I was initially there at the post engineer's officer at Dugway as second lieutenant, and later made my 18 months, first lieutenant. And then a major, it was between majors, it was a major slot. So they had me signing the papers, not doing very much. And then the major came in, so I went over and just did admin work at the post headquarters for the next, 5-6 months before I got out of the Army.
My
major accomplishment there was learning how to shoot a .45 well. Absolutely nothing to do at Dugway. I had bought a second-hand National Match .45, so myself and another couple of the lieutenants, we'd often go out in the evening and just shoot jackrabbits.
Okay. All right. Well, that's a usable skill for later in life. And what about when you left, what did you think about what the United States was doing in Thailand? In terms of, especially the massive buildup that occurred, as you mentioned, after August of 64 with the Gulf of Tonkin incidents and this massive influx. What did you think about that aspect of our policy there? Did you think it was going to be productive?
Well, I had no idea whether it would be productive or not. I was for the policy. I was not. I was never against the the Vietnam War or our efforts in Thailand, or even later when I got to Laos too.
Yeah.
Well, otherwise I wouldn't have stayed for 9 years in Laos. So, I see on the emails and on our TLCB net just recently, this past few days, some of the people were talking about when they left Thailand, went back to the States in the late 60s and 71, things like that. Getting met at San Francisco Airport, baby killer this, baby killer that. The times I went back, because I was in civilian clothes, that didn't happen. And I didn't see any incidents like that. If I had seen it, I think it would have bothered me quite a bit.
Yes. But then again, you were another significant difference perhaps for you and for a lot of people that worked in Thailand and Laos. You worked in an area where you could see you were making an improvement where you were. You were improving the situation. I would imagine you got some quite a bit of gratification from that.
Well, yes. I mean, in Thailand, I mean, that year in the Army, we were not doing the civil affairs work.
Right.
We weren't improving things necessarily with the Thai.
Right.
But we were working with a hell of a lot of Thai, and especially,
yes,
as I said when I got there, we had over 100 Thai working for us. We had a small number of GIs and a large number of Thai. By the time I left, I think we had about the same number of GIs, 150, but we had 465 Thai working for us. And I think, we'll back up a little bit. I think one of the most impressive things I found in my time in Thailand is you take an Army PFC who's a road grader operator, and you give him a 30-man Thai crew. In effect, he's a platoon leader. You say, go out and build a road. And if there's a problem, let us know. Otherwise, come back in a week and repave this road, oil it, spread rock, gravel on it, roll it. If there's a problem, let us know. If there's not a problem, just come back and tell us it's done. We had one guy that I'd like to run down. I think his name was Loban. He was a farmer from Iowa or someplace in the central U.S., but someplace he had learned about electricity. We got the word filtered down to do a full rewiring on Camp Yusertai, which was the, where the colonel stayed over closer to Grand Town. And nobody really knew very much about electricity except PFC Loban. So he made out the bill of materials. We ordered, several tens of thousands of dollars worth of, generators and wire and heavy wire, inch diameter, copper wire and everything. And it eventually came in, and Lobeck goes over there with his team of Thai electricians. They install everything, and we throw the switch. All the lights come on, and kudos come down from the group, ninth log commander to the 44th engineer group commander to the company commander, filter down to me. And Lobeck, called me, "You did a goddamn good job." He said, "Well, Lieutenant, what do I get out of it other than a thank you? Well, what do you want?" I said, "Well, it's coming on planning season. Can I get an early out of the Army for 3 months?" We'd call up the first sergeant and say, "Yeah, that's possible."
Yeah.
So that was his reward.
But get to go home and help with his family farm. Yeah.
But this was,
that's cool,
at least in our engineer unit there, very common with our enlisted troops and our NCOs. They were just, you gave them, 10 or 20 Thai to work with, and the job got done, with, very little supervision.
So. That's pretty impressive. That you could trust your lower enlisted ranks like that.
Right. Well,
that's very impressive.
Yeah, I don't know why, but it worked. with all the other things I heard later about problems in Vietnam and the like, or just in the U.S. military in general, I keep throwing back to this. Give the guys an opportunity to perform, and in general they'll perform. You'll find a deadhead now and then, but
it's very impressive. And you're saying Yusertai. That's U.S. Army?
They call it U.S. Army Thailand.
Okay.
And that was our the headquarters. And we also called it, Ninth Log. That was the headquarters of Ninth Log. It was changed in later years to you support Thailand. U.S. Army support Thailand.
Okay. Great. Well, I think this pretty much covers your first tour. Did you want to add anything else?
Not now.
Okay, great. All right, then I guess we can end the first interview with Mac Thompson. Thank you very much.
Okay.
That's great.